Yes.
Okay, so that was email. Now let's move to more real-time stuff. So after the NLS Automate System from Engelbart, I guess the next really big project that looked at this support for collaborative work with the CoLab. And once again, it's something that was done at Xerox Spark. And it was a meeting room that was equipped with terminals at each seat and a large shared display. So not unlike what we saw in Engelbart's pictures of the NLS system. So what they did was to look at how to support the small groups for typical work. So they developed three tools, and I'll probably talk about these more when we go into the more detailed classes. So one was called Board Loader. It was just a whiteboard, except it was shared. So you could get up and draw on the board, or you could, actually I'm not sure with these computers how you would do it from your seat. So maybe it was only on the large wall. Cognitor was a system to outline ideas. What they noticed is that it's very rare that in a co-located meeting where everybody's together for a small amount of time, people will start writing documents. They tend to write outlines and agree on where we're going to write this report, or we're going to do this thing, or we have this list of action items. So an outlining tool was more important than one for just writing plain text. And then I had another one here called ArgMotor, which I think is interesting. It's called an argumentation spreadsheet. And the idea was to have a system where you could keep track, as the meeting goes, of what arguments are being said to support or to counter some decision that needed to be made. Because oftentimes what happens is you have a meeting, at the end of the meeting you have decided something, and then a month, 2 months, 3 months later, you get back to this and say, oh, we decided this, but why did we do this? Because things have changed, and so you want to revisit the decision, but you haven't kept track of why the decision was made in the first place. Now, there are some people who are very disciplined and take notes and write minutes, but this is a very hard thing to do. So the argumentation spreadsheet was more a system where you could write an argument and connect it with lines that say it supports this or it goes against this. And you could just keep track of what was going on in the meeting. This work in the CoLab invented the notion of what we call WYSIWYS. What you see is what I see. You remember from traditional graphical user interfaces? WYSI, what was it?
WYSIWYS.
WYSIWYS, what you see is?
What you get.
What you get, yeah. So, here it's WYSIWYS, what you see is what I see. And it's the idea that you're really sharing stuff, and what's on my screen is the same thing that's on the shared screen, what's on my neighbor's screen. Now, what they did is they created a number of systems and tried this, and what they found is that if it's strict, if it's really everybody sees exactly the same thing, it's frustrating. Because people like to share things, but they also have to have their sort of own space. So they then turn this into the what you see is almost what I see. And the almost here covers variations in the what they call the congruence, the fact that things are the same at the same time, in the same location, and they view the same thing. So I think this will illustrate things a little bit better. Here you have a long document that you assume is presented in the window that's scrolling. So if I am viewing this part of the document, if I have a strict view congruence, strict WYSIWYS, everybody is going to see the same part in the document. And if one scrolls, everybody scrolls. If one types something, everybody sees the changes. There are times where it's very useful to have this. Is Google Doc strictly WYSIWYS like this?
No.
No.
Why?
Because we can see different parts of the same document.
Right.
Although, something weird happens sometimes. If I'm working on the bottom part of the document and someone is adding more lines up,
it's going to make
you scroll. My screen.
So one obvious way to relax this strict view congruence is to say, well, you know, people can view different parts of the document. We still have the fact that if I type here, the other person can see it by going there. So, or if our views were overlapping and I changed the parts that overlap, other people see it. So that's for the view congruence. And there is the time congruence, which is that sometimes it's good that if you make a change, it shows up immediately. Sometimes you want to work on it by yourself until you're happy with it, and then sort of make it visible. Now, of course, we start seeing problems there in terms of how to implement this, because if I make changes that others don't see, and you make changes that I don't see, we may be editing the same part of the document in different ways, and at some point we're going to have a conflict. But that's part of life, and the system should support conflicts and conflict resolution. So these concepts of, WYSIWYS and relaxed WYSIWYS are very important in all these systems that do one form or another of shared editing. I think in Google Docs it would be important to have a way to synchronize views, to say, well, I take the, you know, I want to show you something, so I want to control your view, these kind of things. And the lesson about all this work, and we'll go into great depths in a future class, is that there's no one solution that works for everything. So you want this, and you want that. You want the real-time, pure real-time editing at the character level, and you also want the thing I'm working in my corner, don't disturb me and all. Show it to you when I'm happy with it. So, and this is because when you do group work, there are phases. There are times where we are all working at one sentence and we want to get it right. There are times where we want to work, you know, on a different part of documents and put, you know, see what it looks like after. So, because there are these various phases in group work of separation of labor and then merging or looking at the result together, you need to support these various types of things. So there's been zillions of shared editors, some for text, some for graphics, lots of them for text, asynchronous, meaning it's really turn-taking, where I get the document, I make changes, and it shows the edits I've made to the next person. A lot of synchronous ones where I see the changes in real time. This is SASE. I'll have a video, I'll show it when we get to that class, where you can see an overview of the document and see where other people are. So that is notion of awareness. And I'm sure when you're in Google Docs, this has happened, where, you know, it tells you who else is in the document, but you don't really know what they're doing.
You can see where the cursor of the other person is, but if you're not in the same part of the screen, you don't see
them. Exactly. We, among others, did the things for graphics, so we created group design, and I'll talk more about it, but we had this way of visualizing what the view of the others one were, so you could tell what others were looking at. So in Grove, which was, I think, one of the earliest ones, there were some interesting features, and I'll get to the, again, in more detail, concurrent editing at the character level, so very much like Google Docs. And this seems easy, but it is very hard, because you have multiple people who are editing what is, in fact, a copy of the document that is on their computer. And then the changes are being sent to a central server. And so solving conflicts is quite tricky, and we'll see the types of algorithms that are being used for making this work. But it sounds like doing it in real time should be easier. No, because there's no such thing as real time on the computer. Unless everybody were connected with the terminal to the same system, and even though. And so you have trade-offs. So you can make it easy in a way, but less nice for the users, or you may want to try to make it nicer for the users, but it's going to take a lot more work. In Grove, you had this notion of public views, but also shared views with a subset of the participants, or even completely private views. This is something I like. It shows you, although I discovered a long time after, in fact after I did the slides, that this was a feature that was never really implemented. And I have to go back when it's to the article, because it looked like they had done it. But so the idea was to have clouds like this that would show where there is activity and when where things have changed recently. Because that's big problem when you do shared editing, multiple people editing the same document. Yeah, you can see their cursor. Yeah, you can see the characters coming in. But you have to focus on that to watch it. And while you watch it, you cannot do something else. By doing something like a cloud, which is maybe less precise, I can see if there is activity while working on another part. So I get an awareness of what the others are doing. And in the same spirit, and this was implemented, they had aging text. The text was first blue when you typed it, and then became progressively black. So you could scroll through the document and see, well, hot spots, even though they were blue. they could have made it red, maybe. But you can see hot spots where things have changed recently. So this is the kind of features, again, that we're done in early systems, and I don't know any recent systems that does that.
And the Google Docs approach has a history when it shows you a list with all the changes, but
yeah.
It's usually that you can navigate and see the changes.
Yeah.
It's like a version you can still see.
Yeah. This is not, I don't think this is what I want to look at. There was work that was done by people in our group for when you have two documents, visualizing, two versions of the document side by side, it's very tricky. And so they had done something using animation to animate the transitions, and it was a very nice piece of work. I'll have to remember to show it when we get back to this. Workflow system, so completely different type of thing. This one is for coordination. And workflow systems have been in use in enterprise software for a long time. And there are various ways of thinking of workflow systems. This is one that is centered on the notion of document. So the idea is that you are in a company that receives orders, and to fulfill the order, then make an invoice, then get paid, collect the money, and then send the receipt. And so the way this is done normally is with physical documents, is the physical document navigates from one part of the company to the other. And you have, sometimes you have envelopes where, the normal path of the document is marked, and you know who to get it to next. So a number of workflow systems works in this way, where you describe a workflow for a document. It has to be written by someone by April 15, and then it has to be proofread and approved and sent by a certain deadline. If the document has this metadata attached to it, then the workflow system can look at documents, track them, and figure out if things are happening the way they should. So if the document hasn't changed by 2 days before the deadline, maybe the document can send an email saying, do you remember that you have to do this by this deadline? And so there was a system called the Coordinator, created by Terry Vinogrand and Fernando Flores in the 80s, that was doing exactly that. In fact, it was more general because it was based on the theory of speech acts. And this is a theory that says that, you know, when people speak to each other, well, they can speak about many things, but there's a subset of speech acts, things you say, that are in fact commitments, promises, requests. So I ask you or I tell you you're going to have you have to turn in your homework by that date. And because I'm a teacher, you're a student, so I don't ask you to commit to it because it's implicit. But so they had this graph here of what can happen. So A requests B to do something. In the simpler case, B says sure and so promises to do it. But A may also want to say no, I won't do it, and then it stops here. Or B can say, well, you know, I can do it by this deadline, but I can do it by this other line, so it's a counter. And, you know, they may negotiate here for some time, and then A may finally accept B's offer, etc. And so they created a system where the speech acts were made explicit, and the system was keeping track of what you had requested and promised, and etc., and reminded you of things that were not happening. Now, this is interesting because this is a system that has attracted immense critique by sociologists who saw it as, you know, putting humans slave to the machine. And there was a complete whole issue of, I think it was the HCI Journal, the most prestigious journal in the field, where there was a very critical article, and then there were commentaries, and then there were response by the authors, and it went for years and years around this. And I think it's a good illustration, and Terry Winograd is someone who came from artificial intelligence and into HCI and CSCW, and so for him this all several social aspects were I was lucky to spend 2 years in Winograd's lab when we were at Stanford. So he's a very smart person. I'm not saying he's dumb. And he was certainly aware of the social aspects, I'm sure, at the time. But he was just, you know, trying to use the system and to try to extract from human communication things you can act upon in terms of a computing system. And Fernando Flores was someone, a linguist, so was really interested in this notion of speech acts. But somehow this work really shows this big divide that I was talking about before, where you have a number, not all of them, but a number of sociologists who, my sense, my take on it, is whatever you do, they'll tell you it's wrong. And I think at some level, the fact that, and it's interesting for a field called, you know, cooperative work, that these communities have not been able to work together better and to understand each other better and to come up with systems that would probably be much better than what they have done each on their side. So the coordinator is something that you need to know if you've been in CSU. I have to find, put online the one of the papers about it. Now in the coordinator, we were doing coordination through communication. People were exchanging emails. They just, a little bit like an information lens, they had to tag it to say, well, this is a request, or this is a promise, or this is a decline. So it was using the communication system to support the coordination. And so that sort of gets us from the sharing artifacts that we saw briefly, and we'll talk more about, to coordination, to now communication, which is a big part of CCW. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, it's a black screen mostly.
Oh.
Yeah, you're young.
Oh, I have that thing in university. Yes, it reminds me to a feature that ICQ had.
But ICQ was a baby. This is Unix talk.
I did a lot of funny things with that because no one knew in the university that we had chat on the
yeah.
thing, you know? So I scared some people with that. It was good, I liked it.
Yeah, so this is a two-person chat on Unix, which, as I was reading the slides yesterday, I was trying to find when it came out, but I don't have a birth date for talk. I don't know which version of Unix it's in. And you said talk, someone else connected on the same Unix system. Originally, it had to be local. Afterwards, I think they did the network version. And the other person's screen would split in half.
You cannot control that.
No. Which is why it was
when one of my colleagues wrote his code for a project, and I knew that he was working on that. So I sent him a chat that I told him, your code is wrong, it's gonna explode. And he was like, he couldn't control that it was not.
And it just splits the screen in two, and you type at the top, and the other person types at the bottom. Now this is a recent. I mean, as you can see from the spelling in there, it's not. This has been taken recently. The thing I find interesting is compared to a lot of chat systems, it's really you see things as people type. You don't have to type and then hit return. And I don't understand why. I mean, I use Skype quite a bit. I don't understand why you don't have character feedback on Skype. I mean, why do you have to? It tells you the other is typing, so they're exchanging the messages to say, oh, the other is typing, but it won't let you know what the other is typing. And I don't know, it beats me. I remember the first time I used Talk outside the lab, it was with someone in the US. And it took a while to figure out the right incantation to make it work at the distance. And then suddenly you have the screen splits in half and you say hi and the other person says hi. And you're like amazed. And then you pause and you say, well, but I can pick up the phone and talk to that person live. And that wouldn't surprise me the slightest bit. But the fact that you could do this through computers somehow was fascinating.
It looks like a computer chatting with you.
Yeah, maybe that's that. I don't know. I to this day, I don't understand why this is so fascinating. That technologically, it's less evolved than picking up a phone. Really,
that's because we are seeing movies with a black screen and a computer playing to the user. Science fiction movies, and so it reminds us of that.
I'm not sure it applies to me, but...
certainly there were movies at this time with that type of vision in the future. I think, I don't know. Probably,
I don't know.
There were only science fiction movies.
The first time that I used one of the features was in a computer class in my school, so I was amazed because I can show with my friends and stuff. That was the reason.
I see. So this notion of supporting group communication, especially text-based communication, gave rise to zillions and zillions of systems. I've shown just two here. We'll see more. This is one that tries to visualize the activity of the various people in the room. So here you have a timeline. That shows when they've been typing stuff. And here is called, this one's called the Babel. Each person is represented by a dot here. And by sort of analyzing the content of the chat, they can tell whether people are more engaged or not, and the people that are engaged are sort of migrating towards the center of the circle, and those are just like, you know, not doing much or are going through the sides. So, and here in chat circles, you have also various visualizations of the chats through various, well, this is timeline based as well, there's bubbles. So the idea has been to try to enrich the communication channel, still having it text based, because there's a big move going from text to audio and to video. Text, you control what you type. If you have an audio link, it's very intrusive. If you have a video link, it's even more intrusive. Although video without audio, I would argue, is less intrusive than audio. But and so people like text because it allows them to do other things and still look like they're engaged. It's harder to do this kind of cheating when you are or lying when you are in audio or video conferencing.
And Babel is written in Smalltalk, could be?
I don't know. What makes you think so?
It's the thing to be that Visual Age, an IBM product for Smalltalk, right?
Okay. Could be. I don't know. And then there's this notion that you go from sharing or text, I mean, exchanging text messages to communicating but through shared artifacts. And so that's, remember at the beginning I told you three circles, you're gonna have to sort this out. So here we have something which is really meant for communication, but it's really more a shared whiteboard where you stick notes or images. In fact, some of these can be live video links, and so you can be you can have a live video in there and then go away. So it's trying to support richer type of communication over this sort of shared board in a sense. And then of course we, from there we move to social networks. But I think it's interesting to look at how social networks have emerged. And I'm not sure I understand it fully. I don't think anybody really understands it. So, and not being a, I think to me the problem with these things is that they are excellent ways to spend a lot of time for not much. And you know, I like tools that empower me. And I don't feel like social networks empower me, but maybe it's because I'm older. I remember a time where I could read all of the net news every day and still do work. So you know, the notion that the internet connects me to the world is something that I've known for a long time. So I sort of feel that I don't need to be connected to zillions of people I don't know. There are already enough people I know who ask me to do things for them, so I don't quite understand the dynamics in social networks, but I'm sure we'll have interesting discussions when we get to this. Another aspect where the group element has been very, very important is network games. And it's something I had, so I assume this is World of Warcraft?
I think this is Civilization.
Civilization, okay, thank you. I knew you would know. Because I had the slides from before and I realized I didn't have the subtitle, and then my son was in bed, so I couldn't ask him. So, the thing is, a number of games were designed from day one to be collaborative. I was looking, I didn't find any image of a very old game on Unix that was only text-based. It was there was a game called Rogue and then Adventure,
and there was a notion, a version of adventure that was in fact multi-user. And this was this, what was it called, the MUD? Multi-user Dungeon and Dragons thing? I don't know, there was a time where this was very popular among Unix users. It was only text-based, so pretty boring to watch. So there were games very early on that were designed to be with multiple players, because frankly, there are not many games that you do just for yourself. I mean, yes, you can do solitaire and things like this, but you know, people in games like to compete. And what strikes me is that now, I mean, I haven't checked, but I think it's hard to find a video game that does not have multiplayer element.
The acronym is MMORPG.
Yes.
Quite a number of single player RPG out there.
Yes.
Because you play your adventure for yourself.
Well, I remember spending too much time with Myst when it came out long ago, but the thing I wanted to say about games is that it's fascinating that it builds its big communities and with a massively multiplayer ones. But also, you know, like my other son plays a lot of the soccer games, and for years, you know, it was you against the machine. And now it's you against other players, and you maybe your team. And I find that more productive in the sense that a lot of stuff I see on social networks. I don't know. It's an impression. But it's not surprising that games have been in this realm for a long time, in fact, because games are always sort of ahead of the curve, in a sense. And what I like about games is that they have to earn their audience. Because a lot of the other products you see, you know, a company decides to deploy it and you don't have a choice, you have to use it. Games, you have to earn your audience, so they tend to be more careful about the user interface to start with, and in the case of the collaborative aspect, you know, the whole support for making groups and alliances and all these things. Yeah, so I'll change this. Yeah, sorry. I guess these are in the mode where they come in one by one. So we had text-based communication, enhanced communication with, you know, images and stuff, games. And now we turn to video-mediated communication. And this is an area that has been also extensively researched. And it's still, to me, incomprehensible why it's so poorly developed. Even though a lot of people use Skype and these things, you know, the early work was done in the 80s there. And in the 80s, we were building systems out of analog video. So we were building systems inside a building, running cables, because we couldn't have good quality visual video. Now, this is something I will talk more about, but it's a holding space. And it's something that demonstrates the amazing power of video. It was an installation created by two artists in the 80s between New York and Los Angeles. And what they did is, in the storefront, they installed a large screen with a projected image. And there was a video camera, and a microphone, and speakers, and the two sides were interconnected. So the people in New York could see and hear the people in Los Angeles, and vice versa. The screen was designed so the people would appear life-size, so the same size. And there was no advertising whatsoever of what it is. It was just put there for a few days, and no nothing. And the thing is, you would see people come by the thing in the beginning, because very quickly it become mobbed, like here. But come by and see a screen, and well, you know, it's another screen in the storefront. And then you realize there's someone on the other side doing the same thing, And instantly they realize that this is not a recorded video. This person sees me and I see her, and people have this amazing ways of catching cues of communication, you know. I move, I stop, I look at you, you do the same, you look, and we realize we're in touch. And very quickly, people started talking to each other, like, where are you? It's interesting because between New York and Los Angeles, it's 3 hours, so it could be still daylight, night in New York, but still daylight in Los Angeles, and they could talk and understand each other, so people, I guess, had not realized that, you know, this day and night thing was real until then. And they were talking to each other, to strangers, but then they started to, you know, call friends and family on the phone to meet at the place, etc. And we have in the lab work on things that involve video communication, that it always has this amazing instant connection kind of thing. 980s, and again, this was at Xerox PARC. They created the concept of media space. They had a group, a research group, and they took half of the group, they put them in Portland, Oregon, which is in the middle of nowhere, but Xerox happened to have another site there, and they connected the two sites through being one large video screen. And what I wanted to do is to see how people were able to work in this dislocated environment and how the audio-video connection could create what they call the media space where people could share things. And this has been the start of a long line of work of using video to support collaborative work. And I'll go into greater details again in the class, but a number of systems have been developed, systems that just do the sort of visual communication, to systems where you see the other person while you work on the shared document, and this is several evolution of this concept here. We'll see ClearBoard, which is, I think, really a very interesting system because it superimposes the two things. It feels like the other person is behind the glass. And then there were other uses of videos that were more exploratory and less literal than just, you know, I see you, you see me, as if we were in front of each other. I think I've shown a... Did I show you a place? Yeah. So they had collaborative versions of it. This image shouldn't really be there, but this one is interesting because this is really two people at a distance playing with each other and playing with a different in size. So that, they just see the outline, but you can, I guess I put this because the same way you could play with Critter here, you could take the other image in your hand and move it along, etc. Bill Gamer did the virtual window, where he was using a camera mounted on an arm, so that you could reproduce the effect of moving your head left and right, to change your point of view, because when you look at the other side through, I mean, you know that, I'm sure you use a Skype or equivalent, you know, the camera is fixed, so you cannot control the point of view at the distance. The various systems have looked at that and other stuff. And so it's been a very active area of research. Interestingly, at the time where we did not have the technology to do it, video plays, it was an amazing technical achievement. All this stuff was done in the 80s and 90s, where ClearBoard was done at NTT, the Japanese telecom, where they were starting to have digital video, but a lot of the work was done with analog video. And it fascinates me and really saddens me that today, you know, when we have all the bandwidth we need, you have the systems that are extremely, you know, basic and simple. And
commercial tool to use.
I'm sorry?
And how to use, you have to start an application on your computer.
Yes.
I wonder why we don't have things like all in space as public facilities on cities, like on embassies, you could have a window to
yep.
to another country.
Yep.
Well, why don't we have that here?
Well, they're waiting for you to build it.
But it does exist. We have the technology, the research yep. is done. So.
I think what's happened with this is it's technology that used to be expensive for good reason, is still expensive for no good reason. The companies, and we know that because we have this large project called DigiScope, where we are building these large interactive rooms, and we want to connect them with high-end video conferencing. They charge you a fortune for a stupid, you know, video codec, essentially. And in people's mind, these are systems done for executives who, you know, don't have time to travel and need to deal with all their business from their offices. And so the market for video conferencing beyond Skype, which is, you know, mostly used by grandmothers to say hi to their grandkids and by people who are, you know, apart and want to
Skype
Skype
is still
such a
personal. It's not as a group thing.
Well, in companies, it's seen as something reserved to the upper management. And all the systems, and we've looked at them, they are designed with a table, nice seats and armchairs, so you sit there. They install the room. They can, you know, they will put the room in here, and they will charge you €500,000, literally. Now, it's a very nice room, very nicely lit, very nice wood table and leather chairs, and they paint the right colors so you look good on the video and all that. But you have to sit because some systems you stand up because you're here, so you have to sit. And the system is designed so it's really the person in the middle talking to the person in the middle. And then the people on the side, well, they can see each other, but they cannot establish eye contact like we do all the time in real life and things like this. And I think that's crazy. I think that's crazy. What we've done in our research and a lot of research on media space is we establish a constant video link. We hook it up, it stays there, it's always connected. A conference, a video conferencing room, you have to book it in advance. You have to say, my meeting is going to start at this time and end at this time, and that's it. If you think of it more as an always-on system, it completely changes the way you use it. And that Xerox PARC and the EuroPARC here, we did a lot of research on this.
It could be like a window with curtains when you don't want to be seen, and you open it every morning.
Exactly. Exactly. I was, for my first sabbatical, that was in 93, so it was really around this time. I was in Toronto, and they had a project called the Telepresence Project. Every office in the lab had, beside the monitor, the computer, they had a TV screen, a camera, a speaker, and microphone. And what you could do is do a, what we call the glance. So that's a short video connection for 3 seconds. So you can see the other person see you, and you can just say, you know, hi. There's no audio involved. And then if you want to connect for a long connection, you ask to connect, the other person has to agree, and then you can stay connected, and people would stay on all day. And by sharing the video, you can feel like you are in the same room. At the EuroPARC, there was an office share that lasted for several years. And so when you have this kind of shared space, that's really what media spaces are around. It's completely different from the video conferencing or desktop video conferencing experience. And I'll show a bunch more tools that were developed and things and how to deal with things like eye contact and all these subtle cues of human communication that are really critical. Now, if you go one step further, I don't understand why he's doing this to me. You go to sharing virtual spaces, and we get to the avatars. So in 1991, it was looking like that. It was a little bit blocky. And this, I believe, is Yeah. Does it still exist?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So the work they did in the dive system was actually more interesting than the image would make you think. The goal was not to have this kind of realism that the well, I don't know if you're talking about realism in Second Life, but the thing was to give people a notion of sharing a 3D space and reproducing the awareness you have of the space in 3D by controlling an avatar in this 3D space. And there were things like objects in the space would have specific properties. So when several people approach that table, every document that one user is going to put on the table is going to be seen by the other participants. So they were really exploring a metaphor for interaction in the 3D world that uses our skills for understanding space, including things like privacy. So if you step away, you can't hear other people, but if you're close enough, you can hear them, and this kind of things. Now, all of the subtleties are lost in things like Second Life, but I think there were some interesting ideas in Dive. And so when Jean-Claude Martin comes in 2 weeks, I think we'll talk about, the type of collaborative virtual environments where you have avatars, because there are also some CVEs where you don't have avatars, and that will be another class by Mehdi Ami, and I haven't represented it here. Finally, there has been all the work on how do we make these things work, and what kind of infrastructure do we need to enable really a lot of these tools. And as I said at the beginning, you know, our computer systems were really designed with different criteria in mind than supporting group work. And here I wanted to show, so do you recognize this? This is again work done by Xerox PARC, but in a different lab, by Mark Weiser, who invented the concept of ubiquitous computing, or Ubicom. And, you know, that was sort of a few years after the CoLab. But the CoLab, if you recall, was one meeting room equipped with a bunch of stuff, and you had to go to the room to work together. In Ubicom, you want this to happen casually wherever you are. So the idea was, you know, you would have these whiteboards, interactive whiteboards. People would come with their tablets. They even had interactive badges that allowed them to know who was where in the building. There were other devices like this. And the idea is that not only you would have these computers of different form factors, I mean, at the time, tablets, you know, the concept was not new, but really thinking about what you used them for was pretty new. And the idea is that all these devices had to be able to talk to each other, to work together, to connect with each other without you having to fiddle with finding the right network and opening the right ports or God knows what. And they built this whole infrastructure where this could actually work. And that gave rise to many, many projects. I mean, Ubicomp as its own conference is a field of its own. But this is work that was done by Norbert Streitz in Germany, where they were looking at how to have cooperative buildings where you have screens on the walls, you have tables with screens as well, you have armchairs, there's a computer here built in, and just by moving this furniture next to each other, they would talk to each other, interact, so you could easily move the document from the table to this tablet here, and from there to the wall, and these kind of things. And the thing there is, you know, the infrastructure you need to build for this to work is pretty significant. And so we'll talk about CSV infrastructure at various levels, again, from low levels networking all the way to toolkits and tools. And then there's the latest craze, which I'm not 100% sure it fits under CSCW, but I think you should know about it, so I've put it in. And that's crowdsourcing. And the idea with crowdsourcing is that some people are finally realizing that there are things that computers can't do. Cooper Dreyfus wrote a book in 1963, I think. The title is What Computers Can't Do. But some people take time to realize things. And here the idea is really to harness the power of a crowd of humans to do human intelligence tasks, tasks that require human intelligence, or still require human intelligence, or the computer is very poor at, and combine these individual small tasks to achieve great things. So one of the things that launched crowdsourcing was a system where you were asked in the game to annotate images, to use keywords to describe images. And by using this system where you gave two images and you had to give keywords to differentiate them, and doing this many, many, many times with many, many different users and repeating the same image, etc., you could actually, through statistical analysis, emerge the right set of keywords. More recently, there was this big thing on protein folding, where you could download a system on your machine where it was, again, seen as a game, where you had to try various foldings of proteins. And by having this done by a lot of non-experts, they actually achieved better results than experts themselves have been able to achieve, and certainly better ones than the computer alone was able to achieve. So this is a very different take on computer-supported programming work. I think it's maybe the other way around. it's more humans, human-supported computer work, exactly. But there are several labs, and where we were at Stanford, they were working almost exclusively on this. They have a whole group at MIT also working on this. So I hope by the end of this class, I will be able to put a lecture on it, which I don't have at the moment, but it's a pretty active area. Yes?
The first one?
Oh, this is the Mechanical Turk.
Ah, okay. I can't remember that.
Because Amazon has a service called Mechanical Turk, where you can actually go on, well, you need an American credit card, last I looked, and you can put out a task there, and people connect to the Mechanical Turk and can, in fact, make money by doing these tasks. So they have a commercial service, and it's done after the Mechanical Turk, which, as you recall, was this chess player that was presented as being a machine playing chess. But in fact, it was a human in there, and it was a trick. So anyway, I'll explain more about the links during the class. Now, to finish this up, so we've seen a lot of systems, and the goal there was really to throw at you a bunch of these things